Good morning, everyone. So good to see you all here this morning in this beautiful weather. What a lovely way to use the morning by sharing it together, and particularly with people that are on the same journey or a similar journey. So welcome to the service of worship. It's called a service because it's meant to serve you, and it is worship because it raises to worth things that matter. This is a radically inclusive spiritual community that's been meeting since 1854, and we welcome everyone. It doesn't matter what God or gods you believe in or don't, and are not sure about, or it doesn't matter how you gender identify, it doesn't matter what political leanings or affiliations you have, and it doesn't matter who you love or prefer to make love with. No matter who you are, you will find this a community that supports you in finding, fashioning and following your own spiritual path. Whatever path helps you to see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all people. And doesn't the world need that at the moment? Please do join us after the service for coffee, but it has to be socially distanced coffee, and you'll find that chairs have been set up in the courtyard and in the annex here. Socially distanced, so you're welcome to sit there or bring a cup back in here and sit socially and have it. And unlike Dan Andrews' advice, you don't have to keep your mask on while you're drinking. These words are from Reverend Eric Cherry, who's from the First Universalist Society in Franklin, Massachusetts. The chalice is lit in our hearts each time that we pray for vision, long for healing, forgive our enemies, comfort our neighbours, and prepare for justice's day. In its light, our hope and compassion are renewed, and the covenantal ties that bind each to all become clear. Now by its sacred flame, the path before us is brightened. Love prepares our way. Harmony is in view. There is no east or west. No south or north.
You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
You'll notice that the music that Brendan has chosen for today's service have a common theme, and the theme is freedom. And of course that tune relates nicely to the slide, although that's a much more modern photo than 1865. I've had two versions of this in my head, so I thought I could adapt it to either situation. But the story I wanted to tell you today was about this guy, Jabari Saeed Jones, who's a Universalist Unitarian from Vermont, from the New England state in the States. And this is part of his story. He was employed as a young teenager, about 17 I think he was, a new employee in the local bakery. And a guy, a white guy, walked into the bakery where he worked and said, "Hi, I don't think I've met you yet." He told me his name. "I'm Jabari," I replied. "Are you American?" he asked. I hesitated. "Yeah." Well, it's just that your name is very esoteric. Well, it was nice to meet you, and he left. I've been called lots of things because of my name, but never esoteric. It's awkward and frustrating to be othered in this way. I keep telling myself that it has nothing to do with me. Maybe he's actually really nice but socially inept, like the cafe manager says. Or maybe he's on the autism spectrum and can't help not have a filter. Or maybe it's just another day of being black in America with a black-sounding name. Jabari actually comes from Swahili and Arabic and means fearless or brave, also bringer of comfort or consoler. I am a spiritual warrior, he says. This is my path, so it's important for me to plunge deep into my discomfort, breathing into it. What is this pain, this anger, and what is at the heart of it? An insecurity? A sense that I do not belong here? I attribute this insecurity partly to centuries of white supremacy in established US law, institutions, and society. The 1790 naturalization law, Plessy versus Ferguson, the hell on earth, conditions of slave ships, auctions, plantations, Jim Crow, and so on, all of which my ancestors survived, resulting in my being alive right now. But the message from dominant culture was clear: you are not American, you are not meant to survive. Not belonging here is a story I've inherited, an American inheritance. I was born and raised here, yet to some, I am always and will always be from somewhere else. I am a free person born into an unfree place. When I feel that unfreedom imposed on me, it gets under my skin like a violent force of forgetfulness. And the important part of the story that I thought needed to be highlighted was the way that words matter, names matter, the way we phrase things using the word esoteric mattered. We need to be more concerned about the language we use when we're discussing things with people and talking through. Now time for our reading.
And an orator said, "Speak to us of freedom." And he answered, "At the city gate and by your fireside, I have seen you prostrate yourself and worship your own freedom. Even as slaves humble themselves before a tyrant and praise him, though he slays them. A, in the grove of the temple and in the shadow of the citadel, I have seen the freest among you wear their freedom as a yoke and a handcuff, and my heart bled within me. For you can only be free when even the desire of seeking freedom becomes a harness to you, and when you cease to speak of freedom as a goal and a fulfillment. You shall be free indeed when your days are not without care, nor your nights without want and grief, but rather when these things girdle your life, and yet you rise above them, naked and unbound."
Every service we begin by saying the words that all accepted here, that all religions are accepted here. And I'm sure that you're very much aware of the concept of religious freedom. It's a very important part of what being a Unitarian is all about. From the music this morning and one of the slides, that freedom is something that sometimes has a modern connotation related to perhaps the 60s when the civil rights movement in America brought it to the forefront of the world. As Unitarians, we have a long history of standing up to religious persecution and prejudice. In fact, as you most probably all are very much aware, many Unitarians have been martyred for this cause. It is a concept that many Unitarians feel very passionate about even to this day. However, there is another side to freedom, and I think in our contemporary society, sometimes this gets lost. And that other side of freedom is responsibility. What does responsibility constitute, I wonder? What does that word conjure up in your mind? Is it responsible to get out and protest and hold up placards? Is that what you think is a responsibility? In a previous life, counselling and tutoring, I would often have clients, many young teenagers as a matter of fact, state that they couldn't wait to become adults at 18 and then they would be able to do exactly what they wanted. In some instances, it was difficult to encourage them to see that freedom seldom meant that an adult individual was free to do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. A simple analogy I used to illustrate this to them was to discuss road rules and the use of the road. That was usually topical for them because many of them had just gained their P plates or their learner's permits. I'd pose the question, why do we drive on the left-hand side of the road and not the right in Australia? Then ask, why can't a person simply decide that they'd rather drive on the right-hand side of the road because at that time they felt they had the right to do it? I mean, it's a beautiful day today. Why couldn't I just go out there and say, I'm not travelling down Osmond Terrace on the left-hand side. I think I'll go the other side because the view's better from that side. You can probably imagine what some of the responses to those questions would have been. Some just sitting there looking dumbfounded at me and thinking, why am I asking such a stupid question? Generally, the responses included such words as, well, it'd be chaotic, impossible, too dangerous. Obviously, they'd never been driven on an Indian road. The object of this exercise was to get young minds thinking about the limits of individual freedom and the fact that as a functioning society, we surrender parts of our freedom for the common good of all. How many times have we heard that, particularly during the Trump era? But this one here, if you want a taste of freedom, keep going. We accept that an individual has the right of freedom to follow their own spiritual path, don't we? Just reflect for a moment on how words such as faith, God, grace, prayer, and even church affect you at times, particularly when they're used in this meeting place and from this lectern. I wonder if there's a feeling of uneasiness when the Bible is quoted or a reading is taken from the Bible. I'm aware that these feelings often relate to something we have experienced in the past or due to our religious development in our formative years. When I think about the formative years, I go back to my own childhood. As a kid before television hit our shores, which my grandchildren have great difficulty in understanding, even understanding a time without computers, Saturday matinees were my favourite form of Saturday afternoon entertainment. Sport on Saturday morning maybe, and then off to the Saturday matinee. Those of you who are old enough to remember these Saturday afternoon experiences will have similar memories to mine of waiting in line to purchase a ticket for 1 shilling or maybe less. Then the rush to get into the theatre, that by that time the newsreel had begun and it was packed with excited, noisy children. The newsreel was followed by cartoons and then came a serial, Hopalong Cassidy, Roy Rogers, The Lone Ranger, Kimosabi. This was followed by intermission and another rush to the theatre refreshment shop to push and jostle until you were up to the counter and able to buy a drink or a packet of lollies. Jaffas seemed to be the preference. They were the favourites because these could be dropped on the wooden floor and they would roll down to the front, making quite a din. And who could get their Jaffa to roll the furthest? After intermission came the main movie, which was often a cowboy or pirate movie. In these movies, there usually was a clear demarcation between the goodies and the baddies. Guess who were the goodies, and guess who were going to be the baddies? All part of the conditioning, intentional or unintentional, that occurs during our formative years. However, it wasn't until movies in the 1970s, such as Dances with Wolves, I don't know if anybody else can remember that one, and Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman, that the First Nations people of North America were given a popular voice and they no longer were portrayed as baddies and they were able to tell their side of the story. So this conditioning process fascinates. Two psychologists that I came across in their writings, Amos Nathan Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, studied this concept of being conditioned, or if you want another word for it, framing things so that you can comfortably put it in some concept into a frame that you can understand. They studied this area intensively. Amos Tversky was born in 1937, then died in 1996. He was a cognitive and mathematical psychologist. I've never heard of a mathematical psychologist before, but he had both those things. He was a student of cognitive science, and that was the area that I worked in with my counselling, a collaborator of Daniel Kahneman, and a key figure in the discovery of systematic human cognitive bias and the handling of risk. He was a professor of behavioural sciences and one of the world's most respected and influential psychologists. He was only 59 when he died. Amos's contributions to the social sciences and to Stanford were monumental. His most important papers, many of which were written with his compatriot Daniel Kahneman, were unique in their depth and in the breadth of their impact. Through a combination of carefully wrought experiments, elegant formalizations, and an uncanny ability to draw upon everyday experience, they often offered compelling accounts of processes and shortcomings that characterize human judgment and decision-making. Daniel is an Israeli psychologist and an economist notable for his work on the psychology of judgment and decision-making, as well as behavioral economics, for which he was awarded the 2002 Nobel Prize in Economics. His empirical findings challenged the assumption of human rationality prevailing in modern economic theory. With Amos and others, Kahneman established a cognitive basis for common human errors that arise from heuristics. Heuristics are simple strategies or mental processes that humans use to quickly form judgments and make decisions and biases about things that are occurring near them. This happens when an individual focuses on the most relevant aspects of a problem or situation to formulate a solution. Some heuristics are more applicable and useful than others, depending on the situation. Heuristic processes are used to find the answers and solutions that are most likely to work or to be correct. However, they are not always right or the most accurate. While they can differ from answers given by logic and probability, judgments and decisions based on heuristic can be good enough to satisfy a need. So relating back to the Trump era, perhaps, where people were out on the streets protesting, and during that era, you remember there was Black Lives Matter, as well as those who were protesting against some of the far-right conservative legislation that was coming out of that government at that time. People would look at those people protesting and make quick decisions about them. And I think the challenge for us is to think about those folk yesterday who were involved in protesting in Sydney and Melbourne, anti-lockdown movement. When you looked at images of them, I wonder what affected you most when you looked at them. Was it the way they were dressed, the way they looked, the length of their hair, colour of their skin? Did those things make you or help you make a very quick judgment about what kind of people they were? Or maybe we're being challenged by those things to look beyond that image and think, what has caused them to be out there? Why are they behaving in this manner? What has driven them to the point that they feel this is the only option that they have of expressing how they're feeling? Apart from guiding the way we perceive our environment, as well as being employed in the plots of movies and novels, framing or characterising is also a commonly occurring practice in politics. There are many examples of this throughout history where one nation, usually a nation experiencing pressing domestic problems, averts the attention of its citizens by framing another nation or minority group as an enemy or group that is the cause of their problems, not the domestic issues. Examples, North Korea at the moment. Take not a minority group, but a whole nation and blame them for the problems that you're experiencing in your country. This then diverts the citizens' attention from significant problems of the nation, such as racism, the inequality of health services and welfare, as well as the enormous inequality of wealth. Monday this week was the Four Corners 60th anniversary. And in that program, some of you would have seen it, I'm sure, they showed the Twin Towers and that disastrous, tragic occurrence that happened back in 2001. But on reflection, Helen and I talked about it for quite some time, it seemed to us that there wasn't a lot of discourse about what drove the terrorists to commit that act. I remember sitting in this meeting place, it must be at least 10 years ago, when one of our members stood up and gave a talk on terrorism, and he had a paper cutout, and he showed the terrorist in front as personal, two people, and then behind that, he pulled out a whole lot of people in a way to explain that behind the terrorist action were a whole lot of other people that had impacted on their lives and put them into a position where they became terrorists. And if you think about what happened after 2001, when America and the coalition went into Afghanistan to stop terrorism, what happened after that, a few years later, when they had virtually achieved their goal of stopping Afghanistan being a place of terrorist schooling and encouragement, they went back in there and it was as if they were going to make Afghanistan become a democratic country, as in the West. And the violence that occurred there, the number of lives that were lost. But from that, and from previous wars, it has been shown that violence begets violence. And Gandhi's words, if we keep on demanding an eye for an eye, it won't be long before the whole world is blind. The only answer to violence is to come from love and to be, as we Unitarians are, I believe, questioning, thinking, when we see something that bothers us, what has occurred before that action. Another classic example of this effect was Hitler's effective use of framing the Jews along with the nations of the world, who were signatories of the Versailles Treaty for the financial problems of Germany during the 1920s and 30s. It's a powerful example of that concept of framing and judging and moving attention away from the real problem. Have you ever considered why Hitler opened the Eastern Front instead of invading Great Britain? Is it possible that part of his thinking was guided by the fact that he despised communism and as such considered Soviet Russia to be a greater threat to Germany's political and social ideology, which he believed was a Jewish construct? Highlighting a perceived inferiority in a particular group or nation whose beliefs differ from the perceived norms enables the development of a feeling of superiority in the dominant group and is used as justification for the mistreatment or the abuse of the framed group or the perceived inferior group. And our nation's history is an example of that. Terra nullius, uninhabited Australia. We can just come in and take over the land and not worry about the original inhabitants. Framing due to religious beliefs unfortunately exists in contemporary societies we're aware of today. An example is the incident that involved a young couple in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago who decided to ignore the lockdown restrictions imposed and hold an engagement party, inviting a reported 69 guests. They apologised for their actions and are now facing a total fine for all guests of approximately $350,000. $5,000 for each guest. They have been subjected to a large amount of abuse through social media and have now closed their profiles on social media. Some of this abuse has been anti-Semitic. The works so far revealed was the use of the words gas chamber by an employee of a major Melbourne hospital. That employee has lost their job because of their anti-Semitic behaviour and is a reminder that even in our multicultural society, there are those willing to attack people on the basis of their religious beliefs. The rise of anti-Semitism is something that many never expected to see repeated after the Holocaust. And yet, sadly, it's very much alive in many parts of the world today. Examples are the rise of neo-fascists in many countries, the plight of the Rohingyas in Myanmar, Muslims and Christians in China, Kurdish people in Middle Eastern countries, Coptic Christians in Egypt, and non-Orthodox Christians in Russia. What about Unitarians? The history of Unitarianism contains the names of those who have been martyred for their right to freely express their religious beliefs. But do we still allow ourselves to become involved in framing others, for example, the fundamentalist Christians? Having had close contact with people from the Paradise fundamentalist group, I have deep concerns about their beliefs and practices, and at times have been disparaging of their beliefs. It is quite common for us outside that organisation to write them off as the happy clappy group. A few weeks ago, there was an article in the paper concerning two politicians, state politicians here, who were deserting their party in order to establish another political party. These conservative Christians were doing this in order to protect their religious freedom. This was in response to the laws on euthanasia and equal rights being passed in Parliament. Their perception is that the freedom to practice their religious beliefs is under attack. However, are their religious freedoms really being eroded? Constitutionally, we're a non-secular society. Back in the 1800s, Muslims were accepted as being a recognised religion in this state. So surely we protect religious freedom. But you only have to look at the Australian Parliament website and the state government website to realise that really is a thin veneer of legislation. It doesn't offer real protection to many religious ideas and attitudes. What about the freedoms of those who are not conservative Christians? What about their religious freedom? According to the article that I read, these religious freedoms are protected by legislation. To my knowledge, the case of euthanasia in countries or states where it's been decriminalised, no one has been forced to partake in euthanasia. However, with a bill pending in state parliament yet again concerning the decriminalisation of prostitution, it will be interesting to see how the influence of conservative Christians affects the proposed legislation and whose freedoms are currently claimed to have been eroded. How much freedom are we prepared to accept when we consider the attitude of other religious groups towards women and children, punishments for crimes that we think are barbaric, an eye for an eye, shunning of medical advice and help because it's against religious belief? How much of that are we prepared to accept? These are questions we need to continue to hold in the forefront of our minds when we're making decisions about this area. And when we come to the point of framing somebody or considering them, we need to consider that everybody is a human being. And I just wanted to finish this morning with a little story that came from the psychologist David Kahneman, who was in German-occupied territory during World War II. He said it must have been late 1941 or 1942. Jews were required to wear the Star of David and to obey 6 p.m. curfew. I had gone to play with a Christian friend and had stayed too late. I turned my brown sweater inside out to walk the few blocks home. As I was walking down an empty street, I saw a German soldier approaching. He was wearing the black uniform that I had been told to fear more than others, the one by specially recruited SS soldiers. As I came closer to him, trying to walk fast, I noticed that he was looking at me intently. Then he beckoned me over, picked me up, and hugged me. I was terrified that he would notice the star inside my sweater. He was speaking to me with great emotion in German. When he put me down, he opened his wallet, showed me a picture of a boy, and gave me some money. I went home, more certain than ever that my mother was right. People were endlessly complicated and interesting.
As we leave this meeting place, may we take with us the peace of being at one with the world and with all humanity. May we regard every contact as precious, every opportunity as unique, and live every moment as we would our last.
We hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.